Right on time.
Hey, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us.
Somebody has definitely been in my studio and turned the volume up on my headphones. I do not approve. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Roosevelt. Tuesday today, single topic, deep dive. All y'all who've been with us for a while know the drill. Today, it's reproductive rights as an economic policy issue, right? As economic rights, really.
Yeah, and we kind of teased this topic last week, and I'm actually... I actually had a conversation over the weekend with a friend who said, what is the, she goes, there must be a money angle to these abortion bills, right? Like, what is the reasoning for this? And I said, well, on the one hand, it's you know, religiously motivated. But yes, on the other hand, you know, not having access to birth control and not having control over when and if you give birth is fundamentally an economic issue for women. Like, think about what happens to a 17-year-old with an unplanned pregnancy. And so we had already had this conversation about exploring this idea of reproductive rights as economic rights and as a matter of equality. It isn't something that is usually discussed in economics, but frankly, it should be. And there is a growing body of research that shows there is a profound connection between access to abortion and the economic mobility and financial security of women.
So we have gotten Caitlin Myers on the phone. She is a professor of economics at Middlebury, where she researches, among many other things, I'm sure, the effects of reproductive policies, how that plays out in the land of actual economic policy. We should say here, Professor, you come with a point of view, that is to say you favor reproductive rights. But I guess, first of all, welcome to the prod. It's good to have you on.
Thank you.
I guess I want the big picture question first, which is, make that connection, would you? For those who might not sort of in the instant get it, make the connection between reproductive rights and economic rights.
I'm happy to. I think I'll start with making the connection between reproductive rights and social science, perhaps, because while I do come with a point of view, I also come primarily as a scientist. And as a scientist, my job is to measure the causal effects of reproductive access and reproductive policy on people's lives. And economists do this all the time. I mean, part of our job is measuring the causal effects of regulations, and particularly in the abortion world, the causal effects of abortion regulations. And so there's quite a large literature in economics that looks at that and teases out those causal effects.
Tell us more. What are the effects? What do you find?
Well, so this literature starts back in the era of Roe, when most people are familiar with Roe v. Wade, which had the effect of legalizing abortion nationwide in 1973. But in fact, before Roe was even decided, five states that we often call repeal states had largely legalized abortion in advance of Roe. And so this afforded economists what we call a natural experiment, this opportunity to look at what happened to people's lives in the states where abortion became legal compared to the rest of the country where it hadn't yet become legal. And then a few years later, when Roe is decided, we kind of have the second experiment where we see abortion become legal in the rest of the country, and we can compare what happens relative to the states where it had already been legal. And what we found is that the legalization of abortion had profound effects on young women's motherhood, the ages at which they became mothers. So the legalization of abortion reduced the fraction of women who became mothers as teenagers by about a third. And it reduced the fraction of women who married as teenagers by about a fifth, primarily through preventing what were then and sometimes now called shotgun marriages that were resulting from unplanned pregnancies. And then those really large first order effects kind of reverberated through the affected women's lives. And we have evidence that for women who delayed becoming mothers because they had access to abortion, those women were much more likely to attend college, to graduate college, to obtain occupations that were kind of professional in nature, and they had higher wages by as much as about 10%, and they were about half as likely to live in poverty as adults.
That's a pretty bright line.
Yeah, it is a pretty bright line. I want to make sure at the outset of this conversation that we make sure people understand when we say reproductive rights, it's more than just abortion, right? Reproductive rights is healthcare writ large on that whole spectrum of things.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, one of the features of this debate right now that's just become so salient, and you see it a lot in the litigation around abortion right now, is that there are folks who are arguing that abortion access essentially is no longer relevant to people's lives, that we've had such advances in contraceptive technology and contraceptive access, for instance, with the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansions. The argument goes that even if abortion was once salient to people's lives, it no longer is. And so I would really kind of carve out, although, yes, reproductive rights is about all of that, I carve out in these analyses and say, let's look at the effects of abortion access right now. We know that abortion access mattered a lot in the 70s. Now that all of these subsequent changes have taken place, does it still matter? And what we see is, yes, like even in the age of the diffusion of more access to long-acting reversible contraceptives like IUDs, even in the age of Medicaid expansion and increasing rates of insurance, although we fall far short of universal healthcare coverage, when people have diminished access to abortion, it still dramatically affects their lives. It makes the people who are experiencing unintended pregnancy more likely to experience an unintended birth and the subsequent consequences for them personally on their lives.
Why do you think anybody who follows me on Twitter or even on this podcast will know that I have a bit of an obsession with framing, right? With the way that we talk about issues. Why do you think we don't talk about abortion and reproductive rights more in this context of economic justice and as an economic issue?
I think that is a fantastic question. It's one that I ask myself a lot as an economist studying reproductive rights and reproductive policies. And I think the answers are complex. I think, frankly, that one of them harkens back to eugenics movements and concerns that connecting reproductive autonomy and reproductive freedom to economic outcomes in some ways has these kind of echoes of a former very problematic era. And I think that's one reason people steer clear of it. I also think it's very difficult to be a scientist working in such a emotional and politically contentious space. You know, it's hard to work in an arena where you're trying to prevent objective evidence when people are going to feel so strongly about the results. And so I think to some extent it was just an understudied area for a while. But there has at this point been, you know, increasing economic attention to it. And it's been linked to the fact that there's increasing economic attention or attention among economists to the fact that if you look at gender gaps in economic outcomes, particularly in the labor market, they are very closely tied to the motherhood penalty. The penalties that women incur in the labor market when they become mothers look very different than what happens to men. And that has caused us to start to pay more attention to connections to reproductive rights.
So what's the best way to fix that issue of not being able to talk about this? Well, you know, we can, we just don't, right? Of not talking about this issue in economic policy terms, right? Because the evidence seems to be stark. I wonder how you get traction then. What do you do?
Well, it's interesting. I think that we're starting to get more traction and more attention now. And I think that the fact that that's occurring has to do with current litigation around abortion regulations. You may be aware that there's a case coming before the Supreme Court this term in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health, which concerns an abortion ban, not in Texas, but in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the state of Mississippi has asked the Supreme Court to overturn Roe. And one of the pillars of Mississippi's argument about overturning Roe and about overcoming stare decisis, overcoming precedent, is to say to the Supreme Court, there's no good reason to believe that abortion ever was or is relevant to people's lives. And that's a moment when economists like me, who might otherwise tend to stay out of like the political fray, who see themselves as, you know, we're the dispassionate scientists and we're going to deliver the objective evidence to the policymakers and they will receive it and we will all carry on. Like, we kind of sit up and take notice and say, that is completely out of keeping with the entire economics literature on how people interact in the labor market. It's out of keeping with the economics literature on gender and family and reproductive policy. And so it's a moment for economists when I think that we have recognized that there's a place for us to speak up and talk about the relevance of reproductive policy and reproductive access to people's economic lives and to make those connections, because the evidence is there, the literature is there, and there's very good reason to believe that it matters, however you might feel ethically about abortion.
It's interesting because it the way that you've described this sense that abortion isn't as important as it was in the 70s, or that there is this argument that it doesn't matter as much to people's lives, reminds me a bit of the overturning by the Supreme Court of the Voting Rights Act that sort of suggested that, you know, preclearance in terms of voting restrictions didn't matter anymore because there was not, in fact, racial discrimination built into our election system. And it sort of feels like there's a preponderance of data in both of these cases.
Yeah, I really look forward to the day when we live in our, you know, post-racial utopia, post-discrimination utopia. And similarly, I look forward to the day when women can effortlessly balance career and motherhood. It's not to say that many of us don't manage to, with great effort, balance it. But when you look at right now in this country, who is it that is seeking abortions? Women from all walks of life do seek abortions, but there is kind of a modal person who's seeking abortions. And that modal person is already a mother, has already had a child, is low income. About 75% of people who seek abortions are low income, within about 200% of the poverty line. Half of them are poor, below the poverty line. And about 60% of them are experiencing some disruptive life circumstance, like the loss of a job, threat of an eviction, breaking up with a partner. The people who are seeking abortions, it's not some random event. They're doing so because of some particular difficult life circumstance. And you look at that, you look at the fact that it's still the case that about nearly half of all pregnancies are unintended, that for any given woman in the United States, there's about a 6% risk in a given year, if she's of childbearing age, for any given woman of childbearing age in the U.S., about a 6% chance in a given year that she'll experience an unintended pregnancy. About 1% of women of childbearing age every year seek an abortion. And overwhelmingly, the women who are seeking abortions are doing so because they are in a tough spot where they don't feel that they're able to parent a child. And when you look at the economic evidence on kind of what happens next if they encounter substantial obstacles to obtaining that abortion, we have evidence, for instance, that they are much more likely to face bankruptcy proceedings, to have their credit go down. We see this evidence of financial distress. And similarly, we see evidence of downstream effects on their education and labor market outcomes.
Yeah, it's, it's not a factor in your life, much like voting, until you actually want to exercise the right to, you know, get that healthcare procedure or actually cast a ballot. Not to put too fine a point on it, but here you are, a social scientist in an incredibly emotional debate, right, which has become politicized to the nth degree. And you now, in this amicus brief you're filing, as I understand it, on the firm's side in the Mississippi case, you have to convince six people on the Supreme Court. Well, you only have to convince five, but you know what I mean. You have to convince the conservative majority on the court to interject sound economic thought into an incredibly emotional legal debate. How do you do that?
I still very much want to believe in rational, evidence-based policy, wherever the policymakers are, wherever the policymaking is occurring. I don't believe it's the role of economists to answer every question about abortion. For instance, most of us at least, are not experts in constitutional law. But there's this one very key element of the argument that is coming to the Supreme Court that economists are expert in. And what I see our role as economists as being in this case is to come forward and say, this still matters. It's not as easy as simply casting aside the precedent of Roe because you conclude that abortion is simply no longer relevant to people's lives. That clearly is completely out of keeping with all of the literature from this like very large, incredible economics literature. I think that's the role for us. Like that's what we as economists can say to the court. And I suppose all I can do is hope that justices of, you know, any political persuasion are open to hearing what the scientific evidence on the question is.
Yeah, I mean, to continue to put a finer and finer point on it, it sounds like what you're saying is, according to your research and according to available data, that overturning Roe versus Wade, would it not, in fact, be a rational, evidence-based legal decision?
I certainly don't think one could abandon precedent on the basis of assuming that it doesn't matter. It would definitely matter. All available evidence is that if Roe is overturned, that many women across a wide swath of the South and Midwest are likely to experience really substantial reductions in abortion access as the providers near them close, and they're facing very long travel distances to other states. Based on economic research, we estimate that about a third of those women who want abortions won't be able to get to the states where they're still available, and that the majority of those women who can't get there will give birth as a result and then have subsequent effects on their economic outcomes. In other words, it's going to matter.
Yeah, well, so look, play that out a little bit, right? Just as a last question, assuming, as seems likely, that Roe is overturned by the court, and let's just work with that as a premise. You accepting my premise doesn't mean that you think that's what's going to happen. But accepting that premise, what happens to women in this country?
It's really going to depend on where the women live. I'm from the Deep South originally. I'm from the Georgia-Alabama border. Women from where I am from are going to experience enormous reductions in access to abortion. And women there who experience unintended pregnancies, a large fraction of them are going to be unable to obtain abortions that they want. And I think what we're going to see is more low-income families in financial distress, disruptive circumstances, facing some really substantial economic challenges. Women where I live now, which is rural Vermont, are not likely to experience large changes in access. Abortion's likely to remain available here. So if I accept your premise that Roe is overturned, and let's also add the premise that then greater power to regulate abortion is returned to the states, then what happens to women next, again, is just going to depend on where those women live.
Yeah.
Professor Caitlin Myers teaches economics at Middlebury College. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's the whole idea of trying to inject sound economic policy into this incredibly emotional debate is just, must be daunting, right? It's got to be.
I mean, yes, all credit to her. I think it's, I mean, it's when you have, a side of this incredibly emotional debate that is like attacking doctors and bombing clinics and calling people murderers, like it's a asymmetrical debate, let's say. The other thing I want to point out is that when we talk about women's health writ large, which is already, you know, underfunded, underrepresented, I think it was not until the 90s.
Under-researched.
Under-researched, exactly. That women were even included in studies because it was like, well, you're just smaller guys.
Right.
When we talk about states where abortion will not be accessible, what we also mean is where women's health will not be accessible, because clinics, you know, are not necessarily one-stop shops. Like when Planned Parenthood closes, and that's where women go for pap smears and birth control and checkups and all of the, you know, breast cancer screenings, like all of the things that go into women's health, it, you have this entire halo of health care and health services that disappear along with access to abortion. And it is, it is profoundly impactful on the lives and, as we just heard, the economic outcomes of women. And frankly, I think this whole conversation argues for why businesses who need healthy economies and and a preponderance of workers should maybe have something to say here. All right, we're going to take a break because, as I said earlier, when we decided we probably were out of questions, I'm only going to keep getting madder. So this is a topic, as we know, that is hard and it's frustrating to talk about. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, we're ready. We'd love to hear from you.
That, by the way, was from the Slack that Molly and I have going during these interviews. You good? Yeah, I'm
exactly.
Good. Wait, got to ask this.
And okay, I was like, do you have any more questions?
Yeah.
Do you? You say bye. Okay, I'm just mad.
All right. Send us a voice memo if you like, your thoughts, or an email. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Or you can call us and leave us a voice message the old-fashioned way. Our new number is 508-827-6278. 508-UB-SMART. We're coming right back.
And we are. We did. We came right back, and it's time for the news fix.
Okay. I've got three, but really only it's like 1.2 or something. It's not really three.
I love it.
It's not really three. Mm-hmm. I want to point out, just because a lot of – so first of all, this is the week of September 11th. There's Afghanistan that has happened. A lot of those coverages are getting rolled in together. But what is happening over in Afghanistan is that the Taliban is trying to set up a government. And today, they actually did set up their government. And for those who have been looking at the Taliban, and I don't know what three people of you out there who are, and saying, oh, they've definitely changed and it's going to be different, that's not what they've done so far. Because in this new government that they announced today – there are no women, there are no moderates, there are people who are wanted by the FBI, there are people with $5 million bounties on their heads for terrorist activity. So that frames this next thing that I'm going to point out, which is my real story, which is a piece I saw on Foreign Policy this weekend, pointing out that the economic system is on the verge of collapse. Banks are basically shuttered and can barely function. And there is a black market economy there that is thriving and going and may be the very future of the Afghan economy. And if you think it's bad now for everybody who's there, right, and it is terrible for women, imagine what happens when the economy actually collapses, when the price of bread goes up 4,000% in a day and a half. Those kinds of things are what's going to happen. So I think the Afghan economy is a story that in my professional life, I'm going to keep more of an eye on. So I just want to point out those two things. Piece in the Wall Street Journal about the new government, and then this piece in Foreign Policy about the Afghan banking system and specifically currency exchange. Really interesting. The other thing that if we did a Make Me Smile on Tuesdays, this would be it, but I'd be smiling because I was crying, if that makes any sense. So today is the day that in El Salvador, Bitcoin becomes an official legal currency. Okay. And one of the ways they're managing this thing is that there's a big government pool of Bitcoin that retailers who are being obliged to accept Bitcoin and use Bitcoin can trade in and out of if they want to get the hell out of the Bitcoin market, which is really volatile. Well, today, the president of El Salvador tweeted, as the price of Bitcoin falls, President Nayib Bukele says, "We're buying the dip, 150 new coins added." And I'm just telling you, that's no way to run monetary policy. That's just no way to run monetary policy. Just don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that.
I mean...
Don't do that.
What I think is so interesting about these two stories back to back is that they are both stories about decentralized finance.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
The story about Afghanistan's money exchangers.
Totally.
Right?
Yep.
Being the economy's last best hope. Yep. It's this informal network of money exchangers. The reason that Bitcoin people believe that Bitcoin will succeed and maybe even save the world and whatever it is that Jack Dorsey tweeted is because of exactly this. Like, Bitcoin can potentially do what central banks cannot. Volatility is a part of that game, and that's real dangerous when you're talking about country-sized economies. And yet, all of the exact same potential is still there. Like, relying on an informal network of money exchangers to keep Afghanistan's economy afloat is also risky.
Don't do that. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's pretty risky.
Yeah.
But I think we're on our, like, kind of messy way to a different way in the world. And this is definitely part of this. I don't know. Like, I actually think it's way too soon to say whether or not this Bitcoin experiment.
Oh yeah, but look,
in particular, is going to turn out.
So I think it's way too early to pass judgment, even though I just did, on what El Salvador is doing. But here's the deal. I think it's too early in the evolution of Bitcoin and crypto in and of itself for an entire country to put its economy on Bitcoin, right? I think that's the questionable move.
It might be. It's like a cart and a horse thing, right? Bitcoin isn't going to evolve to the place that people think it can get without a country putting its entire economy on Bitcoin. So maybe El Salvador is like the canary in the coal mine, or the push, or there's a bunch of metaphors that are swirling around in my head now because of coffee. So I'm just
all right. Anyway, you can go ahead.
Interesting. We live in interesting times.
Yes, we do.
Let's say related to the Texas abortion law. And to be clear, I've actually been like refreshing Twitter all during the show. Sorry, mainly because Texas Governor Greg Abbott just now, as we were starting to record, signed the elections overhaul. The one that the Democrats walked out over. I'm going to stop calling it the elections overhaul. Mm-hmm. Signed the voting restriction bill that has gotten so much press, but has not yet, at least as we're recording this, signed the abortion law into law. It is not yet officially a law, which I think is kind of interesting. However, that has not stopped people from trying to collect the personal information of doctors and pastors and whoever else, and women who are seeking information about or actual abortions. So for the second time in a week, prolifewhistleblower.com, which lets users submit anonymous HIPAA-violating tips about people that they think may have tried to receive what is constitutionally protected health care in every other state, has been shut down. Thank goodness. GoDaddy booted it last week, which we talked about. And then the Washington Post reported that their new web provider, which was described, I think, over the weekend on Twitter as like sort of a far right web host called Epic, also took it down because, again, the tip line violates almost everybody's terms of service because it gathers private information about third parties. So, look, if the thing that brings this idiocy down is the fact that you can't just like share people's private information on the internet.
Whatever it takes.
That'll be something, at least. Yeah. That'll be something.
Yeah.
And not to, I heard a very frustrating interview this morning on this very topic, which is what brought it up. Okay. So as we're having this conversation about potential booster shots for adults in the United States, we still, just as a reminder, don't have vaccines available, approved vaccines for children under 12. Right. And the pressure is only increasing. And the pressure is not from like randos on Twitter, right? It's from pediatricians and pediatricians groups and public health groups. And of course, all these parents of kids under 12 who are going to school and are increasingly going to be stuck inside because the windows can't be open because winter is coming. And I heard a really unsatisfying answer from Dr. Fauci on NPR today about this topic. And I think it is fair to say, and especially like doctors aren't, nobody wants the FDA to rush a process, right? But doctors now are starting to be like, yeah, you actually do know though need to be efficient in this process. And if we're spending a ton of time and research and money trying to figure out if we can give healthy 20 somethings or 40 somethings like myself third shots, I would actually prefer personally that you give the third shot to my immunocompromised mom and then quickly, with some haste, figure out whether my 8-year-old niece can get her first shot. Like, prioritize that.
Yep.
Come on.
Yep. Yeah.
That's it. Okay. Okay.
All right.
That's it for the news fix. Let's do the mailbag.
Yep.
Woo.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
All right, so we talked about IKEA last week, getting into the resale game, reselling its lightly used furniture. Here's Christian in Ohio, called us to share his favorite IKEA furniture hack.
If you have a cordless drill around and two pliers, you can take the Allen wrench that's included in a piece of IKEA furniture, and you can use those pliers to bend it, and it will snap off so that you can have just a straight piece of that Allen wrench that you can then put in a cordless drill, and you can use that to drill, to screw in and out things. And it may sound like a pain, but you only have to do this once, and if you keep that little straight piece of Allen wrench, You can use that to disassemble and reassemble furniture. So if you're moving, this is a really nice thing to have. Never get wrist cramps again. Thanks, guys.
That's a good hack. Also, blisters. Not just wrist cramps, but blisters from those stupid allergies.
But blisters, that's really true. Also, though, I think like my little, I have like a little cordless screwdriver in addition to my drill, and it has Allen wrench.
Oh, Allen wrench bits, yeah.
You just put them on there. And there you go. Yeah. I mean, I like the hackiness here. I like the DIY because you already, it comes with one. It's probably the perfect size and whatever. But yes, there are lots of ways to automate this process. Yeah. And also, I mean, I'm just going to like, spoiler alert, our feedback is so amazing today. I love it. I love that. And I love this next voice memo because I am a child about the fart joke that I made last week.
Hi, this is Sophie from Turner Falls, Massachusetts. I really appreciated when Molly mentioned that she thought that Patty said thanks for making me fart because I thought Patty said thanks for making me barf. And just was like, oh my God, I'm such a child. And now I don't feel like such a child anymore.
Okay. I love our show and I love our audience so much. And then you know who else I love even more? Patty! Because Patty called back to clarify. Okay. Patty, I hope you're taking this
Molly,
in the spirit.
This is Patty calling from Southlake, Texas.
Yes.
And I really do appreciate for making me smart. Yes. Smart, not fart. Oh, thank you.
That's the episode name on this podcast, this episode.
Smart, make me fart. Not fart.
Do a little SEO right there. Come on, Tony Wagner, or whoever's in charge of this now. I don't even know. We're doing a little reorg. Make me fart.
Oh, my goodness. I love you. I love our audience. I love you, Patty. Oh, this is glorious.
All right, here we go. One more. Let's hit it.
Hi, my name is Mike from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Mike. And I found your podcast about 3 years ago when I got cochlear implanted and I needed to rehab and had all kinds of podcasts sent to me. I've been listening ever since. And you've helped me recover my hearing. And thanks for helping me recover and thanks for making me smart. Have a good day, guys.
Oh, you too, Mike. That's great. That's awesome.
That's
truly awesome.
Amazing.
Super cool.
Yeah.
Super cool. Also super cool is that we now can do transcripts of these episodes to make this podcast more accessible for people like Mike and everybody who needs it. And you can find them on the show notes page. They're posted the morning after we do the show. So, you know, a little lag while we do all the processing, but they're there. And we hope you can use
thank it. You, yeah. By the way, to everybody who emailed and tweeted us about that, because yes, that is like table stakes accessibility. And we are sorry we didn't do it sooner and we're excited to do it now.
Yeah,
so.
That's cool.
Keep an eye out and tell your friends. Appreciate it. All right. And now we're going to leave you with it. And thank you to our team, by the way, including and especially Tony Wagner for making that happen. Yeah. We are now going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Today's answer comes from Dave in Washington.
One thing that I thought I knew and I later found out that I was wrong about is that the credits at the end of the podcast are for skipping. You guys actually have managed to make listening to a list of people's names and what they do for your podcast entertaining. And I, and most likely those people, very much appreciate it. Thank you.
That's cool.
Oh,
that's
it's cool. Working.
There you go.
Working because we couldn't do it without them. And I just put in the Slack to all of those people who are really tired of me already. Can we add a make me fart and a make me barf question? Because that's really funny. Okay. All right. I'm a child. You, if you have put off emailing or sending us a voice memo, clearly you now see the benefit of doing that. It both entertains, informs, and delights us. Send us your answer to the Make Me Smart Barf or Fart question. Consider calling us and leave a voice message. At our new number. I'm sorry. I'm fired. 508-82-SMART or 508-UB-SMART. I won't do it again. That was the last one.
Going back
ever.
To the well. One too many times.
Just one too many. No, it's jokes get funnier the more often you repeat them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a true story. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by the wonderful, patient, and extremely adult Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner writes our newsletter, and our intern, who's amazing, is Grace Rubin.
Yeah, Grace did a bunch of stuff on the transcripts, too, so shout out there. Charlton Thorpe is across the studio glass from me, mixing by Emma Erdbrink. She's doing that later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez, as all y'all know, composed our theme music. Bridget Bodner is in charge. Star Nieves is actually in charge. no matter what Brigitte says.
It's true. Sitar, we joke a lot, but like, you don't mess with Sitara.
Yeah. Don't mess with Brigitte either. Are you kidding me?
Really good point.
Yeah.
Really good point.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.